This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
There is a queer angle to every issue, and we will find it. But don't expect us to be nice or politically correct. Nothing is sacred, and the team will be finding the queer and profane wherever we can on Joy 94.9. Is nothing sacred?
Hello, you are on Joy 94.9. This is Nothing Sacred on your Monday night. And it's Steph here in the studio with James. Hello, James.
Hello, hello. Hi, Steph.
Hello, and Claire. Hello, Claire.
Hi, how are you, Steph?
Welcome, everyone, to your Monday night. So, tonight, great show. I've been calling people. We're going to be calling people from all over the world. We've got someone from England who sounds like they're in America. We've got someone from Canberra, someone from Sydney. It's kind of multicultural-ish, international cast of thousands slash seven. What we're talking about tonight is climate change, but not the environmental side. We're going to be talking about the social and economic side of climate change. So very shortly, we'll be on the phone with Matt Grudnoff from the Australia Institute, one of the leading think tanks in economics in Australia. And also we have some conversations with Dr. Stephen Lewandowski from the University of Bristol and Daniel Spencer from the Australian Youth Climate Coalition about people who don't believe in climate change and why, and maybe what we could do about it. Doesn't seem to be. I won't spoil the punchline. You'll have to wait and see. We are going to be chatting with Matt Grudnoff from the Australian Institute. He's a senior economist at the Australian Institute, one of the country's leading think tanks for policy analysis. Matt has spoken and written widely in national media about economic responses to climate change, and we're thrilled to have him on the show today. He's on the phone from Canberra. Are you there, Matt?
I am. Good evening.
Good evening. Great to talk with you today.
Hi, Matt.
So,
great to be here.
None of us are economists, so you've got a couple of scientists and medical people in the room, so we're hoping you can help us out a bit in the economics department. So we've heard a lot about, in the last 10 or 20 years, different ways that Australia or countries can respond to climate change. Can you just talk us through some of the different options in terms of economics or policy models?
Sure, sure. So the one that I suppose economists advocate the most is a price on carbon, and that can be through a carbon tax, which is essentially you put a price, say $30 a tonne. So if you emit a tonne of greenhouse gas emissions, you have to pay $30. And the idea behind that is that people will there'll be an expense in emitting carbon, and so people will try and do less of it. So they'll introduce technologies into their business practices that reduce the amount of emissions they have. The other major form of price on the carbon is called an emissions trading scheme, and it's very similar to a carbon tax, but basically instead of the government deciding what the price is, say $30, they basically auction off permits, and so therefore if there's lots of cheap ways to abate, then the price will be lower, but if there's more expensive ways to abate, then that'll push the price up. They're the main two sort of prices on carbon. And then there's all sorts of other ways you can do it. So you can do it through regulation. So in the US at the moment, they're basically telling power stations, for example, that you have to reduce your emissions by X amount, or you've got to introduce this particular technology, or you can't do something in this particular way. So it's basically the government regulating. And the other way is the government can spend money, so it can encourage polluters not to pollute by paying the money, and that's essentially what the direct action scheme in Australia at the moment is. So it can tell a firm, if you introduce this particular technology to reduce your emissions, we'll pay you this amount of money.
And are there examples from overseas where something like the carbon price has been effective, or do companies find ways around it? Has it been effective in reducing carbon emissions?
Yeah, so a carbon price is particularly effective in Europe. They have the emissions trading scheme version of it, and it's reduced emissions by quite a lot. Europe collectively has reduced its emissions by large amounts. But also in some of the states in the US, so not the US as a total, but some of the states in the US and in Canada have their own emissions trading scheme that they've set up together, and that's helped reduce emissions. California's one of the main ones that is driving that. So certainly an emissions trading scheme or even a carbon tax is quite effective. And in fact, in Australia, if you look at our emissions, in the 2 years when we did actually have the carbon tax in, emissions fell quite quickly. They fell by about 25 million tonnes. And then since we've gotten rid of the carbon tax, almost the same month that it happened, emissions flattened out and then they started increasing again.
And can you remind us and our listeners what we have in place at the moment?
Well, at the moment we have what the government's calling its direct action scheme. So effectively what it means is the government says to firms, if you can think up a great way of reducing your emissions, we'll give you some money in order to do that. And they effectively bid for it. So if somebody has a really cool way of reducing emissions at say, $20 a tonne, and somebody else has a good idea at $15 a tonne, they basically get into what's called a reverse auction. And they bid down until the government finds the cheapest way of the people who are bidding to reduce their emissions. But the problem with this scheme is it's good for small amounts of emissions reduction, but there's no real incentive for firms to get involved or to understand how their emissions are affecting their business. So for example, if you tax somebody, then businesses that want to reduce their costs will either employ people to explain how they're producing emissions and ways to get around it, or they'll become experts themselves because they've got that incentive immediately to do it. But if the government says, well, we're going to have this auction scheme and you can bid if you want, but you don't have to, then, you know, if you're a table manufacturer, for example, or, you know, you produce some sort of good, you might be really good at producing that good, but you don't really know much about carbon emissions and how to reduce them. And, you know, you'd have to go and learn and you'd have to hire somebody, and it seems like a big hassle to fill it all out. So there's less incentive for them to basically get involved and reduce their emissions.
I was just thinking, Matt, hi, Claire here. In terms of other models in other countries, places like Denmark are now producing 140% of their national energy requirements, aren't they, through wind and other and solar and other methodologies. How do they rate in these international measurements of carbon emissions? Are they fairly low now in those particular countries, which are doing those other things successfully?
Certainly. So, electricity generation is usually one of the largest sources of a particular country. It's certainly Australia's largest source of emissions. And if you're able to reduce your emissions through renewable energy, then that reduces a large whack of your emissions. And so being able to generate your electricity from renewable energy effectively reduces your emissions quite substantially. About a third of Australia's emissions currently come from fossil fuel generation producing electricity. So if we were to move to 100% renewables, for example, that would basically reduce our emissions by a third. So countries like Denmark and Germany and France have been able to reduce their emissions by producing low carbon technology. So in France it was nuclear, but in other places like Germany and the Netherlands, they've been able to reduce them quite substantially through renewable energy.
Matt, we do have to go to some messages, but please stay on the line and we'll be back right after the break. You're on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLB TIQ community radio station Joy 94.9.
Hello, you are on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9, and we are talking with Matt Gradnoff from the Australia Institute all about economic options for dealing with climate change.
Yes, and it's James here, and I was just wondering as well, in terms of the options, you know, we've obviously heard to death all of the different options in Australia, and obviously as well, while that's been happening, the costs have changed quite significantly of all different kinds of power production. But I'm interested in terms of what's changed, I suppose, even in the last 5 years in terms of wind and solar, and what's predicted to change over time for, you know, renewable energies and that like.
Sure, sure. So whereas things like coal and gas have basically not changed much in price over a long period of time, in fact, they've gone sort of up as the price of coal and the price of gas have gone up, renewables have been doing the opposite. They've basically been falling quite quickly in price. At the moment, probably the cheapest renewable energy, particularly in Australia, is wind. But solar is falling quite quickly. So at the moment, it's wind, but probably in the next few years, so about 4 to 5 years, solar will actually be cheaper than wind power. And at the moment, wind in particular is actually cheaper than new built coal. But we have this funny situation where almost all the power stations, all the coal-fired power stations in Australia, are actually past their use-by date.
Like Hazelwood.
They're actually quite old. Exactly right. So they're all 50, 60 years old, and they were only sort of expected to last about 40 years, and they basically keep repairing them. But what this means is the capital, the cost of building those power stations has been written off. So effectively, there's no capital cost anymore. It's just the cost of the fuel. So while new-built coal is more expensive than wind, coal where you don't have to pay for the power plant because you've already paid it off effectively is actually cheaper, slightly cheaper than wind at the moment. And so we have this weird sort of interim period where the power station hasn't completely failed because it's still not quite old enough to completely collapse. But we're getting very close to that. And when we do, we'll have to make a decision about what kind of power we want to replace it with. But wind isn't quite cheaper than these old coal-fired power stations. And so it's kind of this interim period where we're sort of waiting for things to change, but they haven't quite got there yet.
So, Matt, what is the danger, though, economically? Because obviously that's the purpose of the discussion on climate change tonight with you. Is it wise, knowing what we know that you've just described, to, I guess, be, focusing so heavily on, we're still a very heavily coal-dependent country. Is it in our interest, I suppose, to move to something that's going down the cost curve rather than something that will eventually potentially fall apart and cost a hell of a lot more?
Well, definitely, yes. So we're better off getting on a power source that's going to become cheaper than a power source that's slowly going to increase. And in fact, if we have to replace it now, it's going to cost us far more. And really, economies are a bit like ships. They don't actually like to change direction quickly. And the quicker you change things, the more costly it is. So we're better off doing things a bit slowly. And so if you know, and sometimes you have no idea in an economy, like mobile phones came along and they kind of just blitz things. And smartphones in particular, just sort of some things you can't really predict and they just sort of happen and you think, wow, that was a bit strange and look how much better things are. In this particular case, kind of, there's nobody in the world, surely, that doesn't realise what's happening in the energy sector. I mean, we can sort of see it coming, and so this is a real opportunity for us to change over with a bit of over a period of time rather than having to do it suddenly. I mean, having to replace power stations by building massive amounts of renewable energy, including, say, renewables with sort of storage, that can be very expensive to do in a short period of time, but over a longer period of time, that transition can happen a lot cheaper. So particularly from an economics perspective, if you want to reduce the cost of having to do this, then you're better off getting on board now and using, say, a renewable energy target like we have and ramping that up and sort of transforming the sector. Unfortunately, if you own a coal-fired power station at the moment, you're making a profit. And if somebody sort of comes along and says, well, actually, we don't want you to sell coal anymore, or we want you to sell less coal-fired power and we want to use renewables, then your asset kind of, which you bought, is suddenly not worth as much and you're not making as much money from it. So you've got an incentive to say, well, you know, I don't think we should go to renewables. I think we should stay with coal-fired power.
Something I didn't realise until I was doing some research for this show this morning was about the fossil fuel subsidies, and I think that's something that is not very well known among Australians. Can you talk a little bit about that and the history of those subsidies and what effect that's having on the economy now?
Sure. So there's quite a few fossil fuel subsidies, which is basically where the government encourages the use of fossil fuels. You'd think that if we were trying to reduce our emissions, The very best, cheapest way of reducing your emissions is if the government stopped paying fossil fuel subsidies. You effectively discourage the use of fossil fuel subsidies, because they become more expensive. And it doesn't cost the government anything. They actually make money by not giving out these subsidies. That would be a very clever way of doing it. But we haven't really done that in Australia at all. And even going back further, when I talked about those power stations that were now sort of 50, 60 years old, they weren't built by the private sector. They were all built by the public sector, and then at a very sort of late stage were sort of privatised reasonably cheaply. And so that, in effect, is also a subsidy. I mean, all those power stations were paid with taxpayers' money and then sort of handed over to the private sector, who are now making money out of them. But even now we have a number of fossil fuel subsidies that basically encourages us to use fossil fuels over other forms of energy.
God. Well, they obviously need to go first, don't they, Matt?
Well, absolutely right. So the biggest one is what's called the diesel fuel rebate, which basically means that, say, things like mining companies, you know, they have this giant mining trucks. They don't actually pay very much tax at all, certainly not as much as you or I if we had a diesel vehicle and we filled it up the pump. They pay a tiny amount of tax on that diesel. And that actually is worth, when you add it all up, for the whole economy. The government's basically handing out $6 billion a year in a tax concession in order to encourage people to use more diesel. So if you can imagine that if a company could come up with a way of, say, running a mining truck on solar or on electricity through, say, solar power or something like that, if you're getting really, really cheap diesel, it's not really worth it unless you can make the solar truck extremely cheap. But if they're forced to pay the same tax as the rest of us, then the diesel becomes more expensive and other options can then be relatively cheaper. And the mining company might say, well, that's actually a better option now. We'll swap.
Matt, we are going to go to some more messages. If anyone's listening in and has a question for Matt, you can text in on 0427 join 949 or email onair@joy.org.au. It's 27 minutes past 10.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Hi there, you're listening to Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9, and we're with the absolutely fantastic Matt Grudnoff from the Australia Institute. And Matt, we're obviously talking about all things economics in terms of climate change, because obviously there's all aspects, both social, environmental, but your expertise is there. I'm interested to learn, obviously the well-published report by Sir Nicholas Stern in the UK, which was many years ago now, and probably has had some updates since around the world in other reports. But Matt, could you tell us a little bit about the economics of climate change in terms of the cost of inaction that was detailed in that report? And has there been any updates to that?
Yeah, sure. So Lord Stern, I think it was in 2007, seven or eight, released quite an important report, which basically looked at two costs, two scenarios, if you like. One was taking no action on climate change, and so therefore, what are the costs if we just allow climate change to grow and grow, and for it to get hotter and hotter and hotter, and to have all those sort of impacts? There's obviously a lot of social costs, but he looked at basically the economic costs. What would it do to the world's economy? And then the other scenario was, well, what if we took action on climate change and tried to reduce the impact of climate change? Well, that's going to also have costs. And he basically compared those costs and showed that that taking action on climate change was substantially better for the economy than not taking action on climate change. And more recently, there's been an update in Australia to that, and that was released a few months ago. And it showed that not taking on action on climate change by about 2030 and beyond would be costing us about 1% of GDP, which doesn't sound like much, but GDP is $1.5 trillion at the moment. So 1% at the moment is about $150 billion a year, which is quite a substantial amount of money. But if we did take action on climate change, it's going to cost us about 0.1% of GDP per year. So by a factor of 10, it is cheaper to take action on climate change and prevent that in the future than basically ignoring it and letting it get worse and worse.
And what does taking action mean in that context? Like, is what we're doing taking action?
You know, so taking action is usually put around the magic 2 degrees, which is a number that people basically came up with because people like round numbers, and scientists said that was probably a reasonable place to be. But it's by no means it's a far less scientific number than people actually think. But usually it's around that. So it's the idea of preventing warming. We've already had about 0.9 degrees of warming already, but it's basically preventing that increase in temperatures to 2 degrees. And usually they think about 2 degrees, we have what's called tipping points, and that effectively means that if you get to 2 degrees, you're unlikely to just then go to 2.5 degrees. You're likely to go a lot further because you have things like permafrost, which holds a lot of methane, which is a very potent greenhouse gas. They begin to melt. And so, therefore, once you get to 2 degrees, you get a whole lot of positive feedback loops, they call them, which basically means that we'll get a heap of global warming out of not more. So they want to basically prevent that from happening.
And how much time have we got for that to take action in that way?
Well, if we've really got a couple of decades, if we want to prevent 2 degrees, we need to take action now, and we really need to radically change how we, particularly how we produce electricity, but how we do things, probably in the next 20 or 30 years. And if we did nothing and sat on our hands, then we probably lock in 2 degrees in the next sort of 20 or 30 years.
And Matt, what would be the consequences of that climate change itself for world economics?
Well, basically, a number of things happen. The first is that human beings basically develop cities, or they developed towns which grew into cities, which grew and sort of grew economies in a time when the climate was very stable. So if you change the climate, then how you grow food and what sort of food you grow in a region completely changes. Mm-hmm. So if you have an area that was a very good food-growing region, and then climate change comes along and it turns it into a particularly poor food-growing region, then you have a large population that's relying on that then has problems. And because, you know, human beings are naturally a fairly tribal thing. We sort of center around countries. You have countries that then have trouble growing their own food. You then suddenly have people start to move around. And if you look at the horrible stuff that's happening in Syria and Iraq with the mass refugee issues that are happening at the moment, can you kind of imagine that on steroids? That's what might happen in the future, as people basically can't stay where they are because the climate's changed too dramatically, and suddenly they want to move to another country. Now, you'd sort of think, well, you know, if there are other countries that become better food-growing regions, well, they can move into those, except that humans don't really like doing that. I
mean, Exhibit A, Australia.
Exactly right. But, you know, all over the world, if suddenly an entire group of people wants to move to the country 2 countries over, everybody gets all upset, and they don't really allow that.
Also, we've got a question from a listener who also happens to be our regular co-host, Jim Hyde. Jim says, Matt, can you outline a doable pathway to get to an economic zero emissions economy in Australia?
Sure. So,
Just
a small question. Probably I can't come up with a complete answer, but look, I think the important areas are the big emissions. So firstly, renewable energy, or at least forms of energy that don't produce carbon. And in particular, I think that solar and storage is going to have a big role to play, and that's because they're dropping rapidly in price. And effectively, you could, if you had cheap solar and storage, that is solar and storage that was cheaper than the current forms of energy, then there's no reason why we can't run the entire Australian economy on that. But Australia is actually quite a strange country in that for a lot of reasons, but particularly around carbon emissions, because we don't have a huge population, we don't produce a huge amount of carbon emissions, you know, compared to, say, China or the US, we actually do export a whole lot of carbon emissions. So we produce a lot of coal. We have a larger share of the world coal export market than Saudi Arabia has of the world oil export market, to put that into context.
God, that's a lot.
We're really the big exporters of coal. Newcastle is the largest coal port in the world. And all this exporting of coal is the biggest single source of carbon emissions. So while we don't necessarily burn all this coal, all these emissions ourselves, we export it off to other countries who then happily burn it. So we're a bit like the dealer in carbon emissions. That gives us a lot of power to actually do and make changes beyond our own small amount of emissions that we actually produce. We could bring in, a tax on exports. We could tax coal exports and force up the price of coal. We could ban new export coal mines and then force up, by restricting the supply of coal in the world, force up the price of coal and therefore make it more expensive and therefore renewable energy cheaper. There's all sorts of things that we can do to basically affect or prevent global warming.
Incentivising the other use of other power, yeah.
We unfortunately have run out of time, but thank you so much for talking with us. We would love to have you back on the show another time. And yes, thanks for staying up late to chat. We really appreciate it.
Not a problem. Thank you very much for having me. It was great.
Thank you.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
You're enjoying 4.9. Hopefully we share your passions. We're pretty passionate about lots of things: politics, environment, saving the world. And our next guest is someone who is very much also into government politics and saving the world. It is Daniel Spencer, who's a campaigner with the Australian Youth Climate Coalition, a national movement of over 110,000 young people. I think that's possibly the biggest Australian youth movement in the whole country.
Wow.
So I had a chat with him about a month ago about his experience in changing people's minds about climate change. Could you tell me a story about where you or one of your colleagues has been successful in changing someone's mind about climate change?
Yeah, so the AYCC runs workshops in schools and also talks to many different people from different backgrounds and different walks of life in the community. I've personally worked in coal communities in South Australia in Port Augusta, where there's been an ageing coal-fired power station there, and, you know, there had been some misinformation around climate change there, and through conversation, not just about the science but also about the opportunities of action, was able to, you know, help people come to the realisation that acting on climate change is actually a good idea and that there can be benefits to it as well.
Can I ask where that misinformation comes from? Where do people get that information?
So there's been some quite long-running and well-funded campaigns, not just in Australia, but in places like the United States, to attack the science of climate change. And, you know, this has been, you know, linked to fossil fuel company funding. So, you know, no wonder some people in the community get confused. But it's also really important to emphasise that the vast majority of Australians and people around the world believe the science of climate change and, more importantly, want to see governments act on it.
So when you have a situation where maybe someone's had some misinformation or, you know, believe something that's not supported by the science, what are the kinds of things that are most likely to get them to come round or to see things from a different perspective?
Yeah, I think, you know, relating to people and having a one-on-one conversation, you know, it's not about, you don't agree with me, so I'm going to shout at you. It's, you know, have a conversation about the facts and provide some of that, but also, you know, hear where that person's coming from. Like, they might have a genuine concern
about what acting on climate change means that's led to them questioning the science. If you're able to get to that core concern of theirs and talk through that, I think you're more able to, you know, speak to their heart and get them to change their mind.
And are there some groups that are, I guess, more receptive than others? Are there any patterns in the community?
Yeah, so I think young people are much more aware of the science of climate change. You know, we've grown up learning about it in schools, whereas, you know, people who are a bit older in the community may not have heard about it, and they may be more likely to listen to certain forms of media that have perpetuated some myths about it. But, you know, we're open to talking to anybody about the science of climate change and about, you know, what the risks are to young people especially about not acting and what the benefits from action can create.
So I guess, as you say, recognise that most people do accept climate change as a reality, but for this story I'm interested in people who don't. So I guess I'm wondering, have you ever... have you spoken to people who, even after sort of understanding where they're coming from and what their concerns are, that they continue to deny that reality?
Yeah, look, you can't change everybody's mind, and you know, that's okay. And, you know, we always come back to the fact that, you know, it's not just about whether or not you agree with the science, but it's actually about what are our politicians and big industry doing about the problem. And we like to keep our focus on that, and you know, do a lot of work in the community to get people engaged in being active on the issue. So, you know, you're not always going to be able to change everyone's mind, but that's okay.
So, I guess for those people, what do you think is, I guess at the core of, sorry, I guess at the core of their belief, is it that they're frightened or that they don't like being challenged or where do those strong feelings come from, I suppose?
Yeah, it's really depending on the individual, and that's why, you know, we really try to engage one-on-one and have conversations with people. That's what we've found to be the most effective way of helping people and understand the science, because you are able to get to the individual concern or what it is. And, you know, there are some people who just aren't going to agree with you at the end of the day, but I think the vast majority, once they're presented with the good information and that, you know, acting on climate change means a cleaner, fairer society, and also the risks to future generations of not acting, most people tend to come around. And the most powerful way of doing that is with one-on-one conversations. So would really encourage, you know, listeners to engage in those dinner table conversations with your friends and your family and talk to people, because relationships is a really powerful way to communicate.
I've got one more question. So there was a study recently by the University of Tasmania showing that Australians were more likely than some other Western countries like New Zealand and Norway to believe that climate change isn't real. Why do you think that might be in Australia?
So I think, you know, we've had a really toxic debate around climate change, and we've also got a really entrenched fossil fuel industry that has, you know, been actively spreading misinformation about climate change. That study you referred to, I think, was from 2010, and, you know, the latest polling that I've seen is actually more and more people in the community, as they're starting to understand the risks in terms of extreme weather, of global warming, much more people are actually starting to understand the science, and not only that, but say we need to act. So there are some people in the community who don't agree with that, but you know, like I said before, you're not going to be able to convince everybody.
Yeah, of course. So is the number of people who do understand increasing?
Yeah, we're seeing more and more people accepting the science, accepting the need to act, and wanting politicians to act. And that's also the vast majority of people that we speak to and have seen in polling. The vast majority of Australians do want to see strong action on climate change.
You can find more Joycasts and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Hello, you are on Joy 94.9. This is Nothing Sacred with Steph, James and Claire. We've been talking about the social and economic side of climate change tonight, and you just heard an interview I did with Daniel Spencer from the Australian Youth Climate Coalition, and we're about to play another interview that I did with Stephen Lewandowski, who's a professor at the University of Bristol. He's a psychologist, and he specialises, one of his areas of expertise is why people don't believe in climate change.
Why do people continue to deny the existence of climate change when the science is so clear?
Well, basically because it is threatening their personal worldviews. That seems to be the most important factor in this. Now, what I mean by that is that all of us have some very deeply held beliefs about how society should be organized, how goods should be distributed throughout a society. And when it comes to climate change, one of the implications of climate change is that we will have to interfere through a taxation mechanism or a price on carbon with the free market. Now, it turns out that a lot of people have a very strong emotional attachment to unregulated free markets, and that for them it's not just merely politics, but it goes far deeper than that. It's a very emotional attachment to the concept of free enterprise and free markets, and whenever that is threatened by a scientific finding, then one of the responses is to deny those findings and to just sort of question them and doubt that they exist, because the implications of dealing with climate change are just considered to be too threatening.
So does that mean, I guess, in their heart of hearts, they know that it's true but they refuse to engage with it? Or is it, I suppose, just looking through a model where it's just not real at all?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I can't really answer that. I do not know to what extent people who claim that climate change doesn't exist, to what extent they actually know full well that it exists, but they're just saying that to protect themselves from the implications, or whether they have talked themselves into believing that it doesn't exist. I don't know that. That's a very difficult question to answer. My best guess is that most people do know that climate change is real, that we're causing it, and that it is a problem. And that on top of that, they've constructed this edifice of justification that allows them not to take it seriously. But deep down, they all know that the scientists are not making up stuff like that. You know, we're talking about the basic laws of physics that have been understood for 150 years, and we've known for that long that adding CO2 to the atmosphere has to change the climate.
I'm also curious, I know you've written a bit about what the implications of that is for science itself. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Right. Well, in fact, my recent work has addressed that together with colleagues. We have looked at the effect of denial on the scientific community and in the case of climate change. And in our view, there are noticeable effects in the sense that scientists, because they're under constant challenge from people who question their work, scientists have actually changed the way they communicate risks, and they have foregrounded the lower end of the risk spectrum and have shied away from fully informing the public about how extensive the risks are. I would argue we have some, you know, evidence to suggest that. And so I think denial, aside from all its political consequences, also has consequences for the conduct of science itself, and it is something that we should all be aware of, that those of us who are working in contested areas, that we should examine our own statements and ensure that we're really communicating the full spectrum of risks rather than shying away because somebody might call us alarmist or whatever.
And do you think this is something that has been increasing in recent years, or does it seem that way?
Well, it's always been, climate science has always been contested from the moment that people discovered that it would actually make a difference to the economy. I mean, no one contested climate science for the first 100 years or so after it was discovered that CO2 would warm the atmosphere, because it didn't have any implications at the time. But I think ever since it became clear that we have a problem, that we have to deal with it, it's been hotly contested, in part by people who have a vested interest, who make a living with fossil fuels. Clearly, for them it's a particular challenge. But yes, I believe it does. It has increased over the last 5 or 6 years, and it has become more entrenched and more successful, in part because the media generally has given undue prominence to the extremely small number of dissenting scientists who are questioning the fact that we're changing the climate. So yeah, in that sense, I think there has been an increase of the effectiveness of denial up to a point. But I also think we've now taken a turn towards a more realistic assessment of the situation. There's been all sorts of developments recently that point in that direction, including the papal encyclica from a few weeks ago, which I think sent a very strong moral signal that climate change really is an issue that we mustn't ignore. And I think a lot of people are sensitive to that message.
But do you think we'll always have some deniers?
Will we always have some deniers?
Yeah.
Oh, of course. I mean, there are people out there now who are denying the link between tobacco smoking and lung cancer. And funnily enough, it often is precisely the same people in the same so-called think tanks who are now denying the link between CO2 emissions and fossil fuels. And that is because both tobacco and climate change involve regulation of industries. And anything that involves regulations or taxation or interference with the free markets will always call the same actors onto the stage trying to oppose the underlying science because it's inconvenient.
To find out more about Joy 94.9, check out joy.org.au.
Hello, you are on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. It's nearly time to go, which is very sad, but we have had a great show. We've been talking all about the social and economic side of climate change. Thank you so much to our guests for tonight. Thank you to Matt Grandoff from the Australian Institute. Thank you to Stephen Lewandowski from the University of Bristol and Daniel Spencer from the Australian Youth Climate Coalition. We have another message from Jim, our other co-host, who says, we're now back to the Is Nothing Sacred caliber show, hard-hitting journalism. That's us. Thank you, Claire.
See you next week.
Thanks, James. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.